Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Ah, there it is. Summertime in Boston. Time for baseball, beer, Cracker Jacks. And by the way, we're listening to Red Sox organist Josh Cantor, who's played at Fenway Park for more than 15 years. Oop, there he goes. But we're going to talk now about some of baseball's greatest legacies, stories, characters, and its connection to American culture with Alex Irvine. He's the author of the comic book history of baseball, The Heroes, Hustlers, and History-Making Swings and Misses of America's National Pastime. And Alex, thank you. Welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So this is a great book, and I should give credit to the artists, by the way. Art by Tom Coker and C.P. Smith.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The book would not be what it is without them, for sure.
Would not be a comic book without it. But why don't you describe, since it's radio, sort of paint a word picture before we talk about what's in it. Sort of, what does this book look like? I was thinking of describing it myself, but I thought, no, I'm going to let the author do that.
Okay. So it's, if you imagine a comic book, it's that size.
Yeah.
Only instead of your average comic book that's 22 pages now, this book is 176. And it has a little bit of front matter, and then in the back, a glossary. And in between, it has about 160 pages of graphical history of the game of baseball.
Right, of events, of the, some of the key players, and the big sort of ways that the game has evolved. Why a comic book? Why did you want to sort of tell this history with a comic book?
There are so many stories about baseball. It's been millions of books have been written about baseball,
yeah.
And I have always wanted to write one. And so this opportunity came along to write this book. And so part of the reason it's a comic book is because that's the chance that came along. but also it seemed like a good idea to me because there are so many arresting visuals in the history of the game. And when you get a good artist involved in a story like this, you can really bring it to life in a way that that maybe even somebody like Roger Kahn could.
That's great. I mean, I love the way it looks. And I love a lot of all the stories in here. It's terrific. So let's talk about a few of them. I mean, I just opened up at random, and this was sort of one of the pages that I had earmarked. The first guy who tried to throw a curveball. I love this story because I didn't know anything about it. The first curveball. Tell me something about that.
Well, this is a story that I ran across for the first time when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I used to read all sorts of books about the history of baseball. And yeah, his name was Candy Cummings, and he was pitching for the Brooklyn Excelsiors, or Excelsior of Brooklyn, depending on the record you're looking at. And it supposedly happened in 1867, and he'd been experimenting with it for a while, and he started throwing it in games, and bamboozled everybody. And one of the fascinating things about that story is that it was only possible for Cummings to use the curveball because his catcher started playing the position of catcher differently, a guy by the name of Hicks, because before that, catchers used to set up way behind the hitter. And that obviously doesn't work if you're throwing a curveball because it's going to bounce right past home plate.
Right.
And so Hicks set up right next to the hitter, and that allowed Cummings to throw the curve in a game. And so simultaneously, a new pitch entered the game, and the position of catcher was completely revolutionized.
That's really interesting. So it wasn't just about a pitch. It was also about the position of catcher that was changed. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah.
That's great. So here's another bit that I loved. You've got a great history of rule changes from 1877 to 1995. And here's some facts that I didn't know. 1879, 9 balls is a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And then that changes.
Yeah. And the relationship between pitcher and hitter changed pretty dramatically in the late 19th century. It used to be even into the 1870s. In some places, the batter could ask for a pitch in a certain spot.
Yeah.
And if the pitch wasn't there, the batter didn't have to swing at it. So the idea of the strike zone came along later. And the idea of throwing the ball so the batter couldn't hit it came along later, too.
Yeah, really interesting. So it goes. Yeah, so 1870, 9 balls, 1880, 8 balls, 1883, foul balls caught on one bounce are no longer an out.
Mm-hmm.
When do you get to 4 balls as a walk? Not until 1889.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's after the first real major leagues, the proto-major leagues are already operating.
Right. So how did you sort of think about dealing with some of the kind of darker moments in baseball? Scandals, it's a difficult relationship with race for many years, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm not a trained historian. I'm a writer. And yeah. So I went looking for stories. And so the book is, I tried to arrange it so there are these interweaving threads, narrative threads that go through it. And the game's terrible treatment of people of color for a long time is certainly one of those stories. And it goes all the way back to Moses Walker. So it was interesting the way that it popped up periodically. Yeah. And so I could talk about that and then move on to other things and then circle back to it. And so you sort of ring these changes generationally as the history of the game goes on.
You did a really nice section on the Black Sox scandal, which, of course, is when the White Sox threw the World Series. And the year doesn't come to my mind.
But 1919.
1919, of course. It should have come to my mind. And that was, of course, when the first commissioner, Judge Keene Saul Landis, takes the seat. Tell me what you know, in researching these stories for this book, sort of what you discovered new about that particular episode or that particular moment in the game's history.
Well, one of the things that was fascinating about Landis is that one of the reasons the owners agreed on him as a commissioner is because he had done them such a huge favor 5 years before when he basically destroyed the Federal League. Uh-huh. And so he allowed it's a long and complicated story, but ultimately he exercised his judicial powers to starve the Federal League, which kept players under control of the American and National Leagues. And so then when it came time for baseball to clean up its act after 1919, they decided they would go with the guy who had helped out the owners before.
Really interesting. You've got a great page here on the first all-black lineup.
Mm-hmm.
Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah, 1979.
Tell me a little bit about that and what kind of, how significant that was at the time.
Well, it was, I remember it. I remember reading an article in the paper about it the next day. And that Pirates team was also, they had a real personality, you know, they're Willie Stargell and Dave Parker and all those guys, and the We Are Family Pirates. And it was, I think, a big watershed moment in the game to have that happen. And then everybody still went out to the ballpark and the game went on, and all the people who were, you know, all the conservative old fuddy-duddies who were worried about the game getting too brown, just it kind of gave up and dried up and blew away after that.
That's great. So I got to pick a little bit of a bone with you here. You have a reference to the Red Sox first. You're in Boston, obviously, so mm-hmm. You're in Red Sox deep in Red Sox country. And I should point out, you're wearing a Tigers hat, so I assume that's your team.
It is my team.
Yeah. I care a lot about the Detroit Tigers, mm-hmm. I must say. I love that new park that they have.
Yeah, it's pretty.
That's a really nice one. But one little measly panel on that 2004 season. Tell me about that.
Well, I was trying to get so much into the book,
yeah.
and you know, looking back on it, there are things that maybe I would do differently, but that's an amazing comeback story.
Yeah.
And the thing was that narratively, I wasn't sure whether more space in the book would benefit the story any more than mentioning it in a single panel would.
I see. Right.
And also, by the time I get into the 21st century in the book, I'm trying to condense a lot of stuff that people are already pretty familiar with. And so I'm not devoting as much space to particular events.
And in fairness, you give more space to the Chicago Cubs World Series victory. And in fairness, it deserves more space because we thought, you know, winning after an 86-year drought was like the most amazing thing ever. But there you are out in Chicago with, what, 108-year drought? So that deserves a little more space.
Yeah, and it was also I was finishing the script toward the end of the 2016 season. And when the Cubs won the World Series, I thought, oh, now I know how the book ends. it was really great. And so I could land on that final image of flying the W at Wrigley.
So baseball, of course, often referred to for a long time, it's called our national pastime. Why do you think the sport has continued to sort of have such a strong cultural resonance in America? I mean, it still has it. I mean, you know, it fluctuates. There, you can debate. There's probably more passion around the NFL at different times, but baseball is still there. It's still doing pretty well. What do you think?
Yeah, and to pick up on that idea of passion, yeah, maybe there is more passion in the NFL, but it's a different kind of passion.
I agree. Yeah.
People admire football players. People love baseball players, and the emotional response you have to watching a baseball game as opposed to watching a football game is completely different, I think. And so there's always going to be this kind of romantic attachment to baseball because that's the nature of the game. And at least that's, you know, I feel that, and that's one of the things that made me want to write this book and communicate some of the romances in the old sense of the word, you know, stories that have populated the game throughout its history.
You've got some really nice moments of some key players here. I just opened up to Yogi Berra. And this page is headed, I didn't really say everything I said.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his favorite quotes, 90% of baseball is mental, the other half is physical. Of course, that's one of his most famous quotes. And he said a lot of stuff, but it's true. A lot of stuff has been attributed to him that he didn't really say, right?
Yeah, and again, that's baseball for you. You know, the stories grow in the telling.
Yeah.
And I love that picture of Yogi, too, with his 10 rings.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. One thing that you reminded me of, I mean, because he became a broadcaster and he was sort of this colorful character who late, sort of after his career, became famous for all of these funny things that he said. He was a terrific baseball player, too.
He was an excellent baseball player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right up there with the best catchers who ever played the game.
Yeah. Right. So who stands out in this book? I mean, who are some of your – tell me one or two of the sort of famous, best baseball characters of all time that really made an impression on you.
Characters? Well, I mean, you got to start that list with Mo Berg, I think.
Mo Berg. Tell us about Mo Berg.
Well, he played for the Red Sox.
Yeah.
And he was, this is in the book so people can go read it and look at it. It was said of Berg that he could speak a dozen languages, but couldn't hit in any of them. He was the kind of guy who was in the game for his defense, couldn't hit at all. Apparently, was good at managing pitchers and was full of bizarre personality quirks. You know, once he read a newspaper, he would drop it and it was dead, and he wouldn't touch it again, and all these other strange things. And then after he went on a barnstorming tour with a Babe Ruth led team of all stars in 1934. They went to Japan, and Berg brought a video camera movie camera, I should say, and he took hundreds and hundreds of feet of footage of Tokyo and other parts of Japan, and then turned it all over to the government after the tour. And so there's all these conspiracies around wondering whether the government asked Berg to go, because there's no reason that he would have belonged on an all-star team otherwise. And that was the footage that Jimmy Doolittle used on his bombing raid in World War II. So
fascinating.
And that same year, Berg was in the OSS, and he became a spy and did all this intelligence stuff during World War II, including a mission to watch Werner Heisenberg give a lecture, during which Berg had the option of assassinating Heisenberg.
Wow. That's a great story. So we literally have 10 seconds left. Favorite baseball memory of all time for you?
Kirk Gibson, 1984 World Series.
Great memory. All right. Alex Irvine, author of The Comic Book Story of Baseball, The Heroes, Hustlers, and History-Making Swings and Misses of America's National Pastime. Alex, thanks so much for the book, and thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, that's it for this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Have a great weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.